Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. On this week's show, we talk about the weekend's big moneymaker, Straight Outta Compton. We'll talk about the history and the music and whether this biopic can get around the problems of so many other biopics. Then we'll wrap up our coverage of my trip to California to hear all about TV with a conversation about one of the headlines that emerged when a network executive said there was just too much TV. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you recite Taylor Swift lyrics better than Sir Patrick Stewart? Care to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We have a rap biography and a television analysis this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. It's a good one. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And sitting directly across from me, Audie Cornish, what do you do at NPR?
I am a host of All Things Considered.
Oh, you certainly are. And Gene Demby, what do you do at NPR?
I want to be Audie Cornish when I grow up.
Don't we all? Don't we all? But what do you do in the meantime?
I'm Lee Blogger for NPR's Code Switch.
Well, you know, our friend Glenn Weldon is on vacation this week, and the bad side of that is I don't get to see Glenn, but the good side is I get to see Gene and Audie, and what is more exciting than that?
I can be curmudgeonly, just, I mean, just randomly.
Can't we all? So as the headlines have been declaring, this weekend Straight Outta Compton made about $60 million, which is a really big weekend for anything that is not a conventional blockbuster. This is the story of NWA, the group that came out, started in the late 80s, only was active for about 5 years, I think.
Yeah.
This is the story kind of how the group formed. It mostly follows Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, and Ice Cube, and sort of follows those three stories through the part where they made Straight Outta Compton and then broke up eventually and all went off to do various things and invent headphones and other wonderful endeavors. I'm going to start with Audie, because I understand that Audie has many Straight Outta Compton thoughts.
I do. I'll do a short take to start.
Sure, sure.
I absolutely thought it was an A in terms of, like, music, movie, biography.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I laughed. The pacing was great. I liked being taken back to that period and being reminded of the timeline. I thought F. Gary Gray did a great job just making this, like, piece of entertainment. And I absolutely knew as people were walking out that they were going to say to their friends and family, oh, you have to go see this.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought it was Hollywood's most direct and I thought successful response to the Black Lives Matter kind of movement going on politically. Selma didn't quite land that for
mm-hmm.
me. And this did it. It tried to draw a direct line historically to say, here's some other context you may not realize.
Right.
Think back to L.A. and Ramparts.
Which is funny because they've been trying to make this movie for years.
Exactly. Well, and later we'll talk about that, about whether it was a cynical turn or not. And then I give it a C for courage and accuracy.
Yeah.
I think the people who controlled the narrative, as I'm sure other people will bring up, obviously controlled the narrative.
Yeah, the Dr. Dre and Ice Cube and Eazy-E's widow are all producers on this movie, so it's less a biopic and more an autobiopic.
Yes, yeah. I'll let you guys jump in. That's my
no talk
an,
about
an
talk,
A and a
talk
C.
Talk about some of the things you would give it.
Well,
C
I think if you're going to sell yourself as free speech heroes, right, with obviously F the Police playing a central role in this, I think you should have the courage to play and discuss other aspects of your music that were not so palatable, right? That were like sexist or misogynist or
homophobic.
And I think that go all the way, you
right.
know, like just be like, this is who we were. But pretending it wasn't there did not work for me. And I thought, oh, well, there's a plus. There's no like deep misogyny in the film because guess what? Women are ignored. Like, we're basically not
yeah.
in it.
Women in this movie are basically like women in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes.
They are either completely decorative, they are service oriented in some way, or they're there to provide kind of bland moral support.
Yeah, I think I counted like 12 lines.
Yeah, and are really there for few other purposes. And I think they do a really nice job of contextualizing why NWA recorded The Police. And there are all these scenes in which they are depicting and dramatizing the conditions in their neighborhood and the way that they were treated that led directly to this song. But they really don't bother with other NWA music beyond that. You really would think that that's almost it. And I know there aren't a ton of records to draw from, you know, particularly involving the original group with Ice Cube. That is disappointing. Now, obviously, the film is almost 2.5 hours long, and it's got all these threads that it somehow has to tie up at the end. But I agree that that was frustrating.
What makes this more frustrating is, so one of the central conflicts in this movie is Ice Cube's departure from the group under very acrimonious circumstances. And so when Ice Cube left the group, there was all this bad blood, and he appeared on the show Pump It Up that starred Dee Barnes, just in passing. And he said some, you know, disparaging stuff about the remaining NWA members. The next time Dr. Dre see Dee Barnes in public, they beat her up. I mean, they, like, beat her up. You know, she's...
And Dr. Dre pleaded no contest to that, I believe.
Right. So. And I mean, it was a big
and
part of the...
And talked about doing it, I think.
I mean, it's like a big part of their story.
Yeah.
A lot of people made a big stink about the fact that that was omitted, and rightly so. But it turns out this is an even more egregious omission because F. Gary Gray was a cameraman on Pump It Up. Like, he knew Dee Barnes.
Really?
He worked for her. And so it was like, there was no way he could have, even pretend to be ignorant to this thing.
That is a conscious decision.
Right, absolutely.
So, well, watching this movie, I thought, that's a lot of topless women for a movie that doesn't give very many women lines. Like, there's a way in which, to me, you can get away with kind of using a lot of topless women in a movie to kind of convey a sense of place and what the atmosphere was, right? And this is the same thing you get into with, as Stephen said, The Wolf of Wall Street, or that people had in a different way with The Social Network, which is, this is how they would have treated women, right? So you can't make stuff up about what the role of women would have been. To me, the critique of the music was always A, violence, B, language, and C, stuff about women. Mm-hmm. That those were the kind of big pillars of that critique. And they talk a lot about kind of the violence critique, and they give them an opportunity on screen to respond to it and basically to explain why they think it's baseless. But they don't really engage the critique about the treatment of women.
And what you're pointing out about Dre is interesting because there is a scene in the movie where they show him leading the cops on this car chase, and he's in his Lamborghini, and then they pull him over. And then they cut away and they don't show the consequence. And also, they're showing a quote unquote crime that is like hot, right? It's like a cool crime.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And it just seems like, so I'm supposed to believe a guy that like hung out with Suge Knight and like managed to come away unscathed was like, you know, one of the kids in Fat Albert. Like, there's like an element to the film where they're all just kids. And I believe that. I obviously believe in like people's multifaceted personalities and nuance. But there was definitely a thing of like, these guys are just charming and like into the music and super sweet and like not at all reflecting the fullness of their personalities. I don't think Ice Cube or Dre would be where they are right now if they weren't a little bit tougher than described in this movie. And even the rehabilitation of E's reputation, I thought was interesting because they tore it down, right? Like, it's because of them that I thought the way I did about Eazy-E all those years ago.
Me too,
And so here we are, you know, music swells. And obviously with the influence of E's family, like, I'm seeing a different depiction, right? Of like how that relationship matured and how they even kind of give it a kind of resolution.
Right.
That who knows if that's true.
Yeah.
They essentially make Eazy-E's story the arc of the film. And then, of course, you have all this fascinating stuff that happens in Ice Cube's career and in Dr. Dre's career that is relegated to postscript.
You know, I actually didn't mind that in some way because I think Eazy-E is an interesting character in rap. And one of my favorite scenes in the movie is seeing him learn to rap.
Oh, my God.
It's
a great scene.
Right?
Great scene.
It's really such a great scene because, you know, it reminds people that, like, it's not like Negroes come out of the womb rapping. Like, it's a learned skill, just like anything else, you know, just like those scenes where they had, was it like Spider-Man where they had him learning how to like use his suit or something?
That's what
it felt like to
it's
me. It was like
montage.
We were watching him have this moment. I thought this is so charming.
It's very warm between them and it's very funny between them. And the thing that frustrates me about it is exactly what you're saying, Audie, which is to me, like, it's not a matter of like make these guys just seem like they're the nicest guys who ever live or make them seem like monsters. I feel like a good biographer could have grasped what I think this movie's really good at, right, which is talking about the intensity and importance of what they were doing and what they were talking about and how unsettled they made people for really valid reasons, right? And for really significant reasons. And I think when you get the power of that music, I think it's great to bring that to an audience that, frankly, in a lot of cases, was not alive for it.
Right. Don't say that.
It's true. Or at least was not listening to, was not.
No,
maybe
no,
listening
you're
to
right.
Music
yeah,
then.
You're right.
I think that's the part of it that's so great, is to have that story of why it was so important. And I think they do a really good job with some pieces of it. I think the treatment of the sequence where they get arrested in Detroit, I thought was very well done, partly in the sense that you realize how much the police seem not to know that they are playing so perfectly yeah. into the narrative that these guys are setting up for themselves. I think that's a very interesting kind of canny sequence, and I thought it was fascinating. And I feel like what makes people like this interesting is to wrestle with that, like, on the one hand, on the other hand, and that's what it is to get older, and that's what it is to get smarter, and that's what it is to learn things. And I feel like I would have enjoyed more a story about them that they didn't make. You know what I mean? Like, I want to see the movie about them that wrestles with all this stuff, but yeah. I don't know if you can get it from them.
They touch on interesting stuff along the way. I mean, we talked about that great scene where Eazy-E learns to rap, and they do a nice job of establishing throughout the movie that part of the story of this group is that not all rappers are created equal.
Right.
And that there is a vast gulf in talent between different members of this group. That MC Ren is not as good as Ice Cube. Mm-hmm. That Eazy-E is not a good rapper.
Not yeah.
And that's really interesting. There are some interesting shots of the movie where once they have become massively successful, they are witnessing riots, but they're in luxury cars. They are suddenly completely removed from it. You have these interesting thoughts about, like, what that means as an artist to suddenly naturally be extracted from the thing that gave your music life in the first place.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of interesting stuff in this movie, and I like this movie fundamentally. It does. Gene and I have both talked about biopics, and immediately when we got back to the office after seeing this movie, we're trading notes on the biopickiest thing in this movie.
Oh, I have a nominee, but I kind of want to hear, Gene, you're not a biopic guy.
I am
typically.
What?
Talk to me about your.
I'm firmly in the anti-biopic.
Yeah, talk to me about your reaction to this movie as a guy who doesn't love biopics.
The thing about biopics is that the characters often seem like hydrants of exposition, like pointed at each other. And there are points in this movie that are very much like that. I mean, there's a scene, and this is my nominee for the most biopic-y moment,
man.
Is when Ice Cube is sitting at his laptop.
Yes,
this
yes,
is such a good one.
Yes, this is it.
I've got a different one, but go ahead.
He's sitting at his laptop, and he's quoting a famous line. He's like, damn, you got knocked the out. And this is going to be beeped out. And then his wife comes in like, how's Friday coming, honey? As if in case you missed the point. He's like, I think it's going to be pretty good. Yeah. And it's like, that's...
They just want to make sure that you know he wrote the movie.
Exactly.
Like, that's the only reason that's there. And it's so awkward.
It's so weird.
This unbelievably weird way. And like, what did you think of the convention of kind of labeling people with captions to kind of skip over... You know, because what happens is people come on the screen and then they put up a little caption that says who they are.
Until they're like Tupac and Snoop Dogg.
Which
at that point, you'd better probably know who they're talking.
But then they just start announcing them like, hello, Tupac. Thank you for joining us here in the booth today. I mean, a lot of those. I mean, first of all, you don't need the little caption for O'Shea Jackson Jr. because he looks exactly like Ice Cube.
He really does.
He just looks exactly like his father.
Yeah.
But it seems sort of superfluous. One of the things.
I needed those.
Did you really?
Yeah. I was like, Ren, okay. You know,
right.
Like.
And then we never see him for the rest of the
movie. I was about to say, well, those are the consultants, right? Like, if you weren't paying for the movie, you were relegated to sitting on the couch and being like, yeah.
Well, and there was a controversy where MC Ren himself was furious he was left out of one of the trailers.
He's tweeted conciliatory things since.
Sure, he has. Well, my nominee for most biopic-y moment of this film, any scene in which your job as a character is to be like the character in the movie Titanic, who at one point says, like, this Picasso will never amount to anything.
Oh, yes,
and your job
yes.
as the viewer is to be like, he's wrong!
Yeah, like the club guy.
So you have like the guy in the club who's like, you should be playing love songs. And you're like, no, they shouldn't. Yeah. Or the manager, Jerry Heller, brings in several possible mm-hmm. label heads. And one says, you're like, call me when you've got the next Bon Jovi. And you're laughing at like, he's so square.
Yeah. Little does he know that he would not be backed up by history.
Yeah, we should talk a little bit about Jerry Heller, about the performance from Paul Giamatti. Jerry Heller was the manager who kind of connected with Eazy-E very early and managed them for a period of time. And when Ice Cube ultimately left the group, it was partly because he felt that Heller was only really serving the one guy at the expense of everybody else. And there's a lot of stuff about contracts. That's one of the problems with this movie, I think, is they're just trying to do a ton of stuff. They're trying to do the contract story and the cop story.
So much document waving.
Rap biography. It's interesting because there's a very good Wesley Morris review of this movie, I think, where he ultimately was disappointed by it. And one of the things he talks about is that the closest it comes to having a strong kind of emotional center is the relationship between Eazy-E and Jerry Heller.
Which is really surprising, right?
I know.
Because, Jerry Heller is supposed to be this, at least in the lore of NWA, is this
as they tell it themselves, which they are.
Absolutely.
You know?
It's actually really surprising that it's like a fairly charitable movie to him, considering like in the lore, he always comes across as like this sort of evil, conniving figure.
Yeah.
Yeah, he leaps to their defense at several points, like comes to their aid at several points.
Yeah.
I thought this was one aspect of the film. I couldn't tell if it was Giamatti's performance or the writing that did feel nuanced, which was the relationship between these young men and the like white power structures around them. So Heller is a kind of paternalistic figure, frankly. And meanwhile, the cops are obviously a more aggressive and malevolent. But at one point, and I won't spoil it for people, Heller kind of has to face off with police. And you were acutely aware that there are like kind of white figures or the structure that these guys don't have power to is like in charge of them and their bodies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. That they don't really have a say in what's going on. And I actually thought it was done really well in a film.
I think that's a terrific scene.
Yeah.
It was a moment. Scene
yeah. And, it's a yeah. moment where it's not just kind of like cops are bad. You know, like there's something that says even the person who's helping you in some way is not allowing you to be in control of your own humanity.
Right.
And I didn't expect to experience anything like that in this movie, and it was just really a compelling moment.
I think that's what I wanted from more of the rest of the movie, and that you look at that scene and you say, boy, there's a lot going on in that scene. Yeah. Whereas in a lot of the rest of it, the scenes are kind of, this is a scene about this person being this way, and that's kind of all that's happening in that scene.
But would it be less fun then?
That's the thing, is like, I don't know what kind of movie I wanted. Like, it might be that the kind of movie I want is really more like a documentary that is kind of looking at the influence of them and everything. I think for the movie that it is, I think it's well made.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember, I think I was on, I did this as one of the What's Making Me Happy.
You did, that you were excited about this movie coming out.
And at the time, I was basing this off the photo of the guys playing them. And if it had been like Lifetime, Saved by the Bell good, I would have been fine with that. Like, I really had a very, very low bar. So when I was in the theater and it was like good, I was like actually pretty surprised.
Yeah, yeah. When I was watching it, I didn't know that was Ice Cube's son.
Even with the eyebrows?
Playing him. Hang on. Playing him. So I'm watching it and the whole time I'm thinking like, they did a great job with this casting. He looks uncannily like Ice Cube. That's amazing. Like, I had not done my research ahead of time, as you can tell. And so then after I read that after the movie, I was like, oh, now I get it. I get it. And I think the guys who are in the movie do a decent job playing these guys, although I don't think any of them, I think the portrayal of Dre is not terribly nuanced in a lot of ways. He's kind of like a very like good boyfriend kind of guy who tells Suge Knight to be less, menacing to people. It's kind of, I mean, I didn't find that to be terribly whatever. A lot of the comedy comes from Eazy-E. I think that's the performance that has the most humor in it.
Yeah, I actually was surprised the actor who played Eazy-E. I thought that was sort of the most, he was the emotional center of the movie. Right. I mean, obviously his relationship with Paul Giamatti's character. But Dre's character is interesting because everyone comes in the movie and says, like, the way people always do in biopics, in music biopics especially, that this person's a genius, right? Like, Jay, you just have this innovative mind. I mean, it's clear to us as people who consume music.
Is it? But as I listen to the Compton maybe because I've never been a super fan.
I mean, his production has always sort of been the saving grace, right?
He's always at the mercy of his guests. Sure. If you listen to the Compton soundtrack, which is the first Dr. Dre record in umpteen years, it is a very mixed bag because it is a very mixed bag of like familiar collaborators. You know, he helped break Kendrick Lamar. Mm-hmm. You know, you have Snoop Dogg and Eminem, but you also have like all these people that nobody's ever heard of. There's actually a really interesting roundup at NPR Music of who here is a rundown of all the people you've never heard of on the Compton soundtrack, which is a really useful thing to see. Mm-hmm.
This is not an area of the history of music in which I would claim enormous expertise, but even for me, I wanted kind of more consideration, I think, of certain elements of their career.
I think the thing I was struck by and sort of talked about the most over the weekend was the idea that for so long, Black artists did not have control of their stories after the fact, you know, through like segregation or just whatever. Yeah. If you look back at jazz, for instance, they just didn't even have access, right? So then once they have the access, hip hop is the music that has like shown us what happens once you have the access and can actually like become the billionaire, right? And then have control of your story. Like it was not lost on me to see an Ice Cube trailer
for Ride Along 2.
You know what I mean? And I just thought this guy just is like money hand over fist. And so on the one hand, I'm sort of like, yay, you know, Black artistry, like tell your own stories, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, they do with it what everyone else does with it, which is to sanitize it and canonize themselves.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of like, welcome to the club. Like, thanks.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting to me, even though it's not what this movie is about. And I don't think they could have fit it in. The fact that like Ice Cube wound up doing what I guess you would consider like the Eddie Murphy sort of.
Are we there
of
yet?
Aging into like, I'm gonna stop being threatening to people. And,
he still's kind of
provocative.
Well, he's also mock threatening. He's like an authority figure.
In terms of output, I'm gonna stop making my output so consistently provocative and make family sort of friendly stuff a lot of the time. It's an interesting pivot. I am confident based on that $60 million take that a lot of folks listening to this will have seen the movie. I'll be curious to hear what all of you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about television, whether there is too much, you know, spoiler alert, probably. And we'll be right back, so stick around.
Support for this podcast comes from TNT. With Public Morals, a new series set in 1960s New York. Here is creator Edward Burns describing the Public Morals Division.
These cops work in Public Morals. Public Morals is what typically would be called today the Vice Division. Back then, they referred to these crimes as victimless crimes. Primarily, it dealt with gambling, prostitution, and anything to do with alcohol and the blue laws.
Watch Public Morals series premiere Tuesday, August 25th at 10, 9 central, only on TNT.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we talked about the biggest movie that opened this weekend. Now we're going to switch gears and talk a little bit about television. Now, I, of course, am overjoyed to be back in the studio with my pals here at Pop Culture Happy Hour after a few weeks away. Now, the reason I was away is that I was out in Beverly Hills listening to the networks explain all about television. And during those presentations, the CEO of FX is named John Landgraf, and he gave an address to the critics in the room. He pointed out that FX research estimates that by the end of 2015, there will have been in 2015 over 400 scripted series running in primetime. That does not include reality shows. That does not include
sports,
news, sports, kids shows, daytime shows. I mean, I suppose some kids shows if they're scripted in primetime, but nothing daytime, nothing like that. It's a lot of TV. And Landgraf kind of took a very assertive position saying, this is too much television. And he said he expected 2015 or 2016 to represent what he called peak television in the United States in terms of quantity. And that then there would be a little bit of a contraction. So we thought that we would talk a little bit about there being way too much TV and maybe some other stuff about the state of TV. So I want to start with Stephen. And here's what I want to ask you. You are a guy who, is often interested in new stuff, but you find it hard to kind of get started, I would say, with new scripted shows. And I know part of that is a timing thing with you. You have kids, you're busy, whatever. Is any part of it a discovery thing in terms of like being overwhelmed by the amount of stuff and having trouble finding the new stuff that you might be interested in?
Yeah, I think I do a lot of filing away. Like, I think I've talked about this on the show before, this alternate universe where I break my leg in several places and suddenly I'm going to catch up on all the things.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of filing away, like, I've heard that show's good. On this show, you know, we're constantly talking about new TV series, and as much as I discover lots and lots of things because of this show, I also tend to watch the first 4 or 5 episodes and then think, I love that show. I will go back and watch Fargo, Transparent, Orange is the New Black, the rest of those episodes, even though I'm not fulfilling the requirement of whatever I'm supposed to watch for the show this week.
Right.
So I do a lot of filing away, like, I know I like that show and I can't wait to someday go back to it at some indeterminate point in the future.
Yeah. How about you, Audie? How do you take in your
TV? Interesting you say that. You say that now because you can, right? Like streaming and DVDs, like we're
in this age
where it's not going away, so you don't feel the same kind of like pressure to get up on these shows. And, you know, one question I had about this, and maybe you can help me understand this, Linda, with his comments is, you know, it was peak TV. Is it too much good TV or just too much TV, right? Like, because there's a lot of stuff masquerading as great that's only okay.
Yeah.
But it has the, like, costuming of what we consider prestige television.
Would you like to name names?
Yeah, I was going to say. I'm curious to see where this is going.
But, you know, The Americans. Mm-hmm. I know people love The Americans. I know it is good. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's great, and I should be stopping everything I do to try and, do, like, catch up with it.
Yeah.
And I think this hit me, frankly, when Tremé and Boardwalk Empire came out, which were HBO shows. Both were good. Mm-hmm. With people I liked, but I couldn't bring myself to watch them. It felt like homework. Like, this is a good prestige television show you should be watching.
Yeah.
And now I just don't feel that at all. You know, when people are like, True Detective is bad, I'm like, meh, didn't matter anyway.
Yeah.
Not going to watch it. You
know? Yeah, I can answer part of this because he did say in his remarks, Landgraf said, that part of the problem is that there is so much good television that it keeps people from finding the great television.
Right.
Now, of course, the problem then is which is the great television and whose ox is being gored? Because I will tell you right now, if there is a single show that I think he has a burr under his saddle about right now, it's The Americans.
Well, I brought it up because it was FX.
Which has been reviewed very, very powerfully and has won a bunch of other kinds of awards. I think they won a Peabody, but does not get a lot from the Emmys in particular. If I think he has one beef with kind of where this is coming from in terms of I can't get even my really best shows that critics say are awesome, I can't get them into that upper echelon of awards nominations and ultimately more talk and whatever, I think that's the show. And I share your sense that one of the things that happens is that a lot of the good to great shows feel unpleasant to watch.
Yeah.
And I, my friend Mo Ryan and my friend Jim Poniewozik have both talked about the difference between something being good and something being for me.
Right.
There's a difference between I don't think it's good, I don't think it's for me, and or I don't think it's good, I don't like it, and I don't want to watch it.
Yeah.
Because The Americans is one that I think is very good. When I have watched it, I enjoy it. It's for me. But I don't want to watch it.
Yeah, the central sort of animating plot in that show is the secret that they can't tell their kids. Mm-hmm. And so all the drama comes from the family life stuff. I mean, well, not all the drama, but the most compelling.
But it's surrounded by all this, like...
I know. Yeah. And I should say, I picked that name out of that also because my husband is currently watching every single episode of it without me. And we have this parting of the ways in the evening where it's like, okay, you go do that. I think you mentioned the violence. I think for me, the underline has been under rape.
Mm-hmm.
I'm maxed out, you know, as that as a plot device. And it has reached the point where like shows that I think I would like, I start to watch them, and when that comes up, I'm just like, I'm out. And I think this gets at something else they talked about, or the debate about this, is people not giving shows a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can now bail on a show because it's not the only game in town.
Yeah, sure.
And that's true.
That's not necessarily a good thing, because now I'm backing into a corner where I'm saying, well, I don't like this, I don't like that, and I'm not watching the show, and I'm not, like, really giving it a chance, you know? So you guys talked about, I think... difficult people recently on the show. And I watched a bit and I was like, yep, I'm out. Mm-hmm. I don't need this in my life. Like, I just don't, under any circumstances, have to sit through a program like that anymore. Whereas in the past, I'd be like, Seinfeld, I guess it's great. You know, like, everyone's watching
it's
it.
It's what's on.
I think that's right. But there is such a blessing and a curse to a limited supply of stuff where it makes people more patient, but it also forces people to adjust their expectations more. And you can see that as either like, it's really great that you have so many choices that you don't feel obligated to get into anything that isn't for you. But you can also see it as like, I think everybody can think of a TV show that it took a little while to grow on them, but that eventually it became something they really loved. I'm sort of famously didn't like the Friday Night Lights pilot.
Oh.
And of course, then it became like, you know, one of my favorite shows ever. A lot of things have taken a little time to grow on me. There's a Hulu show that's coming that isn't out yet. It's coming, I believe, in October, called Casual, that has Michaela Watkins and a bunch of other people. It's almost like a mumblecore-y kind of comedy, which is not always my thing. But it takes a while to develop. And then once it does, I got really into it and I watched, I think they gave us 5. And it took me a little time to get from the first one to the second one. It was a little of a kind of push because I like her so much, Michaela Watkins. But then after that, I was in and I watched all the rest.
Mm-hmm. And, and cancellations feels so much more permeable now, the barrier between a canceled thing and an active thing, because more and more stuff is constantly regenerating on other networks. You get these reboots. You get a show like Futurama that went and came and went and
or
came.
A show like The Mindy Project that gets canceled off of Fox and then picked up by Hulu so that they can basically keep going just like they were before.
Right. And or, you know, I mean, a show like Arrested Development, where, you know, a show that is like canceled and everybody's in morning, a show like Community, you know, Community, I guess now, but what's to stop?
Yeah, but the most interesting story I heard about that is one that involves a show I don't watch called Longmire, which is a Western that ran on A&E for like 3 seasons. It was beloved, but it was beloved by old people. And on a network, even on cable, if you're ad-supported and all that stuff, you run into a problem where advertisers don't want even your healthy-sized, very enthusiastic audience if they're older.
Right.
Netflix, on the other hand, Netflix doesn't rely on advertising, and they're doing really well adding old people.
Yeah.
They picked up Longmire, and they're making another season. And now Netflix is making it like part of their pitch with this show is like, look how great we are. We're looking out for the stuff that, you know, maybe advertisers don't think it's sexy. It doesn't hurt them at all that like they can pick up that. They can pick up BoJack Horseman. Their whole brand is so all over the place content wise that they can afford to do that. It's another example of like, everybody is kind of, stuff proliferates partly because it has several chances not to die, which I think is what you're saying.
There are so many opportunities to keep these things alive.
There are a million ways not to die.
That in a way, cancellations, even if you're like, oh, a show I like is canceled, it's like, wait a couple of years.
Yeah. No, it's true.
And also, you know, I think the boom has been good for diversity, right? Like, we don't know if this is going to be sustained, but we do know that there's just much more programming out there where you can have a mix of people, where you can have a transparent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Again, I'm definitely, Bob Mondello, I know you can hear me, and I'm still saying it. I definitely am one of those people that's just like, yep, the movies aren't doing it for me.
Yeah.
They are not doing it at all. I take TV every day, all day, because the options are limitless. Yeah. TV seems to get and can, right? Because obviously movies are so expensive to make, but that there are so many stories out there to tell and that people can be compelled by them. And I guess since the bar is low financially, you can try and tell them all. And I think TV does expose the poverty of storytelling by the movies right now, by the big studios.
Certainly by the big studio movies.
By the big studios. They are just proving that it's like, this is what we think mass entertainment is. Despite all of this TV out there telling us that all kinds of people are watching all kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's just, you know what? Lady, we don't care about your money. We are making Captain America Thor, you know? Like, it's just going to be that all the time. And so I love going to the movies, but you know, I'll take peak TV.
Yeah. I mean, the TV diversity thing is like, in some ways, they're doing better. I would say they're doing better.
I am definitely, you know.
No, I know. I would say they're doing better with, they're definitely doing better with race than they were for a while, particularly on certain outlets.
Which is not saying much, but.
Right. But on certain outlets, they are. I think they're doing, certainly transparent and some stuff like that. But I got to tell you, like sitting at Tor, it was still like, the lack of women executive producers is kind of still shocking on new shows.
That I get, but I yeah. even mean portrayals.
No, I know.
Right? Like,
I mean,
I forget what big movie report came out a few weeks ago
yeah.
talking about like
oh,
how
bad.
Few lines people had that were not, you know, straight white couples or men. This does bring me one other thing I mentioned. I actually have watched one or two of their pilots that they have put up mm-hmm. just to be like, it's a pilot. We don't know if it's
yeah.
a show yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself being like, oh, I'm glad this isn't going to be a show. And I can't tell if that's a better model or not, right? Because
yeah.
there's so many programs that like got better
yeah.
over time.
Yeah.
And
pilots are so rough.
Yeah,
pilots are really rough,
and maybe it could yeah. be better. And here I am just being like giving my gladiator thumb, you know, just like thumbs down, you know, whatever this is.
They love to trumpet that system as like this democratized whatever.
Yeah.
But they do not strictly follow the voting. Like they don't hold themselves to it. Like they have people vote, but they don't hold themselves to it. They're not bound by that voting system. And when you try to ask them, like, well, then how do you do it? Then they get very, very slippery. They took some questions about the fact that they picked up the Woody Allen project that they're doing, straight picked it up, didn't put it through that process,
no.
just kind of picked it up and said, we're going.
Yeah.
And people were kind of saying, like, that's an interesting exception to make. Like, it's been very interesting to
watch.
Well,
they act like they're so different. They're like, data.
Yeah.
You know, like, data names, we know about you.
But they don't tell you any
but
of
then
it,
in the
you
end, it's
I mean?
Just like any old schmuck TV, you know, chief, basically, where you're like, I kind of like this, I don't like that. Like, we're going to give this a shot because we think some people like it and some people
yeah.
don't. I mean, Netflix is a good example. I think the Netflix chief said something like, people think it's all about the data and it's not. And I'm like, yeah, no kidding. But of course, we don't know because they don't show us the ratings.
No, right.
There's so much sleight of hand there. That
yeah.
I think I'm not bullish on what streaming is doing.
That's actually Landgraf's biggest like beef. He has like a years long beef with people from Netflix being like, everything we make is awesome. And he's like, tell me whether anyone watches it. It's like a long standing beef of his. Anyway, again, I would be interested to hear what all of you think about whether there is too much TV. Again, I'm running a series of essays and stuff on the blog this week as we tape this, and also they'll be running next week. So by the time that's all over, I will have completely exhausted myself writing about television, and I will never have anything more to say.
There will be peak TV writing, you're saying?
That's yeah. right. It will be peak TV writing. When we come back, we will be getting to our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast comes from the new Starz original comedy Blunt Talk, starring Patrick Stewart as Walter Blunt, a British import intent on conquering the world of American cable news. That is, if network bosses, a dysfunctional news staff, and misguided decision-making don't derail his mission first. Don't miss the series premiere Saturday, August 22nd, only on Starz.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite and final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I am so glad to have Linda Holmes back.
Oh, yeah.
Not just because I don't have to host anymore.
But mostly.
And not just because there's this gigantic glut of great TV writing on the Monkey C blog instead of just me posting Pop Culture Happy Hour episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And not just because Holmesy came over for beers this weekend.
True.
I don't know, man. I'm just glad to have you back.
Oh, thank you, dude. Here
we go.
I'm punting.
But you have to come up with a real one.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm punting slightly because I had this delightful weekend in which I did not consume much entertainment. And right before we came into the studio to tape, I just spent 15 minutes, which is actually a lot of time to spend, on Twitter looking specifically at the feed, Everything Goats. And if you go to Everything Goats,
Everything Goats on
Twitter, their handle is Everything Goats. Mm-hmm. Their name listed above it is Goats. And their description of what they are is, and I quote, 100% goats.
and it is
pictures of goats, cute pictures of goats, puns involving the word goats, gifs of goats running around, just pantsing around, being ridiculous. I have found over time that I am a sucker for goats. At one point, I recommended the mashup of Taylor Swift's Trouble mm-hmm. and a screaming goat.
Yes.
So it's like, ah!
Yes, you
did. Yes, trouble, trouble.
Yes, you did.
And so, like, I am a sucker. Send me your goats. But I'm just, I'm so glad every once in a while to take a break from whatever is aggravating the hell out of you in order to watch goats run around on their front legs or scamper around hallways or cuddle with dogs.
Nice.
Everything goats. Thank you for existing.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Audie Cornish, can you possibly follow
I cannot.
What is making you happy this week?
But I still have something that you guys will appreciate, especially after the sentiment that Stephen shared about Linda being back. The novel A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. This book is something like 730 pages long. And when I was first told about it by Saeed Jones, the literary editor over at BuzzFeed, who I love, I was like, that's a really long book. And I'm very childish. Like, yeah. I have many things to do and I cannot do that. You know, fast forward a month and a half later, I have cried every tear in my body making my way through this book. And it's about four friends who, these young men, and you're with them as they start off their lives with kind of crummy jobs, crummy apartments in New York City, and as they grow into men. And it's really a book that kind of made me feel empathy, and it made me feel like what it was like to be inside of a friendship which was not my own, and to understand how to feel very, very deep love and respect for someone who's not your family, mm-hmm. and kind of how that develops almost, but since it's 700 pages, like in real time, like I felt like I was going through the years.
Yeah.
And I just found it so incredibly compelling. The kind of B plot is about one of the young men has suffered childhood abuse, and it's about how you live your life in the aftermath of that. And I just recommend it to anyone. You can just read it a little bit at a time. It's called A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara.
Thank you very much, Audie Cornish. We will throw a link to that on the blog so that all of y'all can find it. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week, sir?
What's making me happy is a podcast that my friends and I do that we are, I'm going to log roll a little bit here.
Sure,
A podcast called Post Bougie.
We encourage that.
We started this group blog way back in the old days.
You sure did, when none of y'all were famous yet.
There should be Ken Burns music that goes over like, pink, yeah.
And now all of us have sort of moved on our careers. Slate. Jamel Bowie is at Slate. Joel Anderson is at BuzzFeed. Tracy Clayton is at Another Round and Everywhere. We've been friends for a long time, and we've been doing a blog, but now we have a podcast that we're actually doing consistently. I just wanted to shout it out and boost the signal.
Nice.
That's what's making me happy.
Wow. Yeah.
So Gene is not just talking about Brett Favre on the Giant Foam Finger podcast. He is also talking on the
podcast promiscuous.
Can I ask how you came up with the name Post Bougie, which I love?
God. I don't know. It sounds really stupid now, actually. If I were to do it all over again, I would probably pick a different name. It was just like, you know, I was a kid who grew up poor, and I was like, I had to like sort of like become a middle class black kid, and I just like was always like shaking my fist at all the sort of like Jack and Jill stuff in the, you know, just like, I would never be one of those people. And so it was like, we're going to be post bougie, we're not going to be bougie.
Fast forward years later and you're in nice frames.
I know. Okay, NPR.
Working at NPR.
Right, I know.
Post.
I know, right. Labels don't matter.
Labels don't matter. Oh, thank you very much, Gene Demby. I got a few little ones when I was out in California. You know, it's similar to what Gene just said. I got to be unfaithful to this podcast with a couple of other podcasts, both out of the Maximum Fun Network, run by our pal Jesse Thorne. I got to be on Jordan Jesse Go, which is my favorite thing about that show is it's completely discursive. There's no topic. You just go in and start talking. It's absolutely my favorite thing because it's so weird. And like Jesse tells like a 12 or 15 minute story about these two kids on a pallet in a lake. It's really funny. Anyway, that was a lot of fun. But I also got to be on Pop Rocket, which is the Maximum Fun version of this show. And I say that because that's what Jesse says. And I got to hang out with those folks and do basically the same show, just in a different room with different people who have a totally different dynamic. It was delightful. It was a lot of fun. I am still better suited for my show. I'm not as good at what they do as they are. Everybody there was very sweet. I had a lovely experience. So that was fun. Also, I have a longtime reader from kind of my television recapping days who lives in the LA area, and sometimes when I'm out there comes and rescues me from the hotel and takes me somewhere. This year, she took me to a taping of Dead Authors, which is a podcast that Glenn has talked about on this show before, that is a Paul F. Tompkins podcast where he hosts as H.G. Wells, and he talks to some author who's back from the dead, which in this case was Steve Agee playing Albert Camus. And so he interviews him about his life and all that stuff. And it's comedy. And it's very, very strange and funny. It's winding there. He's actually winding that project down. So there's only a couple left. But it was delightful and tons of fun. And it was very kind of Laura to take me. So thanks to Laura. Also, while I was at Press Store, I found out during the NBC session that despite the fact that NBC is their comedy brand is like dying on the vine, they have a new show coming from Mike Schur, who is like my favorite showrunner in comedy. He makes Brooklyn Nine-Nine, made Parks and Rec. He's doing a new show for NBC. Hooray for all of us. That made me really happy. And finally, I learned today that like in 3 weeks, I'm going to the Toronto Film Festival. And at the Toronto Film Festival, they're going to have The Martian, which is based on a book that I've talked about on this show before. In the movie, Matt Damon plays the guy who gets stuck on Mars after the rest of his spaceship leaves and they think he's dead. Oh my gosh. I love that book. I have recommended it to people sometimes and found myself feeling guilty if they found the math a little unentertaining at times. But the book overall is super great. It has tons of math because he's a scientist. And that is making me very, very happy that I'm going to get to see it very soon.
Excellent.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Audie at NPR Audie. You can follow Gene at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
It's awfully good to see all of you again.
Likewise.
And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will indeed see you back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, right now, check out Ask Me Another. Can you recite Taylor Swift lyrics better than Sir Patrick Stewart? Care to moonwalk with Asif Manvi from The Daily Show? Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.